ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Good afternoon. Selena Green with you today. You might know quite a few folks who've headed north to Beef Australia 2024 in Rockhampton this week. Well, the Prime Minister Anthony Albanese is there just a short time ago. He announced $519.1 million in funding for the Future Drought Fund. You're going to hear some more about this over the coming days, but that will, we're told, go to programs to help farmers and regional communities prepare for the next drought and build climate resilience. And so the money would be included in next week's federal budget. So more detail to come. But speaking of the federal budget, in this half an hour, we'll find out what the grains industry wants to get out of it. And we'll also talk about wild dog attacks because they're continuing to be a concern along the Victorian South Australian border.
As is the nature of these things, the dogs haven't gone away and been working on doing a lot of work on our boundary fences, but yeah, we lost a ewe and several lambs late last week.
Please do let me know if you've been seeing more wild dog activity in the area, and are they crossing more into South Australia from what you can see? The talkback number is 1300 222 891, or you can send me a text at any time throughout the program on 0467 922 891. Well, first today, over the weekend, the Indian government announced it has suspended a 66% tariff on imported desi chickpeas. That's significant because India is the world's biggest consumer of chickpeas. Australia hasn't been able to export chickpeas to India since those large tariffs were introduced back in 2017. The suspension is initially just for 1 year, but Grains Australia Pulse Chairman Peter Wilson says it's still good news. He hopes Australian-grown chickpeas will soon be making their way to India.
A welcome announcement and a very generous announcement by the Indian government. But obviously after a lot of hard work and very respectful engagement over many years by our people in government and industry have stayed really, really close to India and to the market, because we just know how important it is, generally speaking, for Australian agriculture, but also for Indian consumers. So this is a great result.
Why have they lifted this tariff now?
You know, India is quite a diverse economy, a diverse geography, and of course climate. So what we're hearing is that the desi chickpea crop, which is the largest pulse crop in India by some millions of tonnes, was probably down 10 to 20% this past harvest season, which has really just concluded in the last month or so. So I think they're realising it's a little bit short. We're seeing the market jump up a little bit. They've been augmenting supplies of pulses with the extension of the lentil shipment being able to be moved and to yellow peas. So they will receive, you know, about 1.5 million tons of yellow peas over the next month or two, but they've obviously decided that they will need some high quality desi chickpeas, and of course Australia is one of the few origins for that product.
You mentioned old stock. It seems like it would almost be too late to influence growers' planting decisions for this year, I imagine, at least in Western Australia. Will it influence your decisions or what you'll plant this year?
Well, I think it will certainly, you know, acknowledge that Western Australia is a very different environment to the East Coast. But for the East Coast, there was already some intentions. You know, this has been a long process, and I should say that, you know, the engagement by that's been made possible by Grains Australia, the industry, and of course, it can only be because of the support we received from Grains Research Development Corporation to Grains Australia to maintain this engagement. And we've been encouraging, and when I was in Delhi in February, we had done a brochure which showed our planting windows and our decision tree windows for Australian farmers, but particularly those where a lot of the desi chickpeas are produced. So we were very careful to talk to our Indian colleagues about the realities of making an announcement that could actually influence production if, in fact, they needed some stock from Australia. So the sowing window up here doesn't really start, so when I say up here, north of Dubbo, it's in the majority of the desert chickpea production region. We're talking, you know, May, June, and of course we know that from 2016, where conditions were quite okay, we saw desi chickpeas sown in July and August. So the sowing window is really only just opened, so it does enable some decisions to be taken to throw an extra paddock in if, in fact, they've got the seed and they're keen to do so.
As the Chair of Grains Australia Pulses Council, Peter Wilson, speaking to Lucinda Joss about the announcement over the weekend that India has suspended 66% tariff on imported desi chickpeas. The suspension is initially just for 1 year, so it applies until March 2025. As I mentioned, the federal budget is being handed down next week, and grain producers say federal road funding must be boosted in that budget to help the sector remain internationally competitive. Victorian grain grower and Grain Producers Australia spokesman Matthew Wiedemann says rural childcare also needs to be improved to help grain businesses and regional communities attract staff.
Yeah, our key asks are around the road infrastructure is falling apart. Road and rail are fundamental to the agricultural sector, particularly for grains when we're looking to move grain. And over the decades of budgets that I've been involved in at that national level, the asks have never gone away. So the $1 billion ask at the moment on the table from most of rural Australia is just a chink in the road, really, to try and get things started, because things are falling apart, particularly here in Victoria, but also other states are also feeling the brunt of lack of investment outside of the metropolitan areas.
We are in a huge amount of debt at the moment, which means spending is probably likely to be limited. What are your expectations in terms of how likely it is to get that road funding that you're looking for?
Well, I think it's got to be very high on the government's agenda to try and rebuild the confidence in rural Australia. When you spend in these areas, that generally flows on to better outcomes for Australia generally in terms of exports and also bringing goods into Australia as well. It also helps with good infrastructure and the needs at the ports. So we've been long asking for a container levy to be put on for biosecurity as well. These are also fundamental areas that we want government to look at. Putting a tax on farmers, as they've tried to do at the moment with the biosecurity tax situation, is not the way to go. And clearly that's why all the agricultural groups have pushed back on that. So, you know, we think there's areas there that they can certainly shape in this budget as well. The other key component of the agricultural area is the rural workforce. And that's an area that is really concerning, and how we can improve those opportunities. Community childcare funding out in the rural area, I suppose, is something that's really important. Attracting people to the region requires investment in services that are there to ensure that people are confident in going out. And, of course, investment, again, in ag skill training. You know, we need people in the workforce, and to do that we have to invest for the long term in education needs as well.
All right, so your top two things that you'll be looking for are on roads and the rural workforce. Anything else you'll be looking for in the budget?
Clearly, around the APVMA possibly needs some investment, even though it's self-funded.
So the APVMA is the pesticides regulator. What are the issues with the pesticides regulator at the moment, and how much money do you think is needed there to address those issues?
I mean, I think a good $10 to $20 million, not just me, that's, you know, the industry needs that input really there to try and improve outcomes that we're currently seeing, because it needs further investment in staff to try and cope with the demand, I suppose, that's coming on. We just think that needs extra support.
That is the Southern Region Director with Grain Producers Australia, Andrew Wiedemann, speaking with Elsa Kennedy. So heading ahead of next week's federal budget. It's due out on Tuesday.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
We're at 14 minutes past 12. Well, currently most of the hemp grown in South Australia is irrigated, but that could soon start to change. Dryland hemp growing trials have proven successful in the southeast of the state. Owner of hemp processor and retailer Good Country Hemp, Mick Anderson, says it could be a game changer for the industry.
Yeah, hemp harvest went quite well this year. We trying different things all of the time. So we had a combination of a dry land crop as well as our traditional irrigated crops down in the southeast. And the results are really telling of what we might be looking towards doing in the future.
How so?
Well, the dryland crop was an interesting experience. Hemp is traditionally grown with irrigation. It's a summer irrigated crop, so we're sowing in mid-November and harvesting in, you know, mid-March. It's a very fast-growing crop. We put in an earlier crop, which was intended to be a dryland crop. We probably put it in hindsight, a little bit too late because we had a very dry finish to last year and it struggled a little bit with a whole lot of different things. But it really told us that dryland hemp is possibly a way to go. If we can get it in earlier and time it right so that we're out of the frost period, then I think it's something that we'll do more and more of. And we've actually got a trial coming up this coming year where we're going to be putting in more dryland hemp in the southeast to with some special varieties that we're looking to work with.
Yeah, are there any varieties that are more suited to dryland farming?
Yeah, well, hemp comes in two different sorts, really. There's day-length sensitive varieties and then there's auto-flowering varieties. And day-length sensitive varieties are not going to be any good for dryland because they wait for the day-length to change before they'll go to flower. What we want is a what they call an auto-flowering variety, which goes to flower for a certain number of days after sowing, no matter what. So if you sow it today, in 40 days' time, doesn't matter what time of year it is, it will flower. So they're the ones we're looking to use for dryland hemp.
And if it is successful, these continued trials with the dryland, would that be a bit of a game changer for hemp in South Australia?
Absolutely will. And the reason for that is we're having to rely at the moment on, you know, top-end farmers who have got the irrigation resources, they've got good quality water and good soil, and they need to be able to fit it into their rotations between November and March. If we can grow dry land, you can imagine in 20 years' time when we go through all of the variety development, it'll be kind of like canola, and we'll be able to use, can I put it this way, average farms, which are growing canola at the moment, let's say, to grow hemp as well. And that's really where we want to be in a few years' time. And so that's going to change the whole landscape of how we grow hemp in Australia at the moment.
And would it be suitable for other areas of South Australia as well?
Absolutely. And, you know, it depends on frost, it depends on soil, it depends on soil temperature when you sow it. It depends on, I mean, it still needs a lot of nutrient, really. It's a fairly hungry crop because it grows so fast and it grows, you know, a lot of biomass. So you can't grow it on poorer country, let's say, but certainly it'll open up the possibilities for a lot more farmers to grow it through the southeast and other parts of South Australia as well.
That is the owner of Good Country Hemp in the southeast, Mick Anderson, speaking with Elsie Adamo. Well, wild dogs and dingoes are continuing to kill sheep on farms around the Big Desert in northwest Victoria after the Victorian government made a decision to protect dingoes in the region and more recently have not yet given farmers access to control options. Merino producer Alan Bennett has lost more than 30 sheep and lambs, but despite that, he's been denied an authority to control wildlife permit. A Victorian government spokesman says the conservation regulator assessed that lethal control would not be an appropriate response when weighing up livestock impacts against the risk of extinction of the local dingo population. Alan Bennett says that's left him powerless to protect his ewes and lambs.
The attacks are continuing. We've had another attack this week. I put in an application for an authority to control protected wildlife for a wild dog, although in their terms it had to be classified as a dingo. And after about a month of toing and froing and lots of time and effort, they denied my application, and basically they said that they couldn't substantiate my claims or I couldn't substantiate them well enough, and that ultimately, regardless of the losses that we've sustained, that they couldn't allow even the destruction of one wild dog as they were that close to extinction. So that was very disappointing, and as is the nature of these things, the dogs haven't gone away and been working on doing a lot of work on our boundary fences, but yeah, we lost a ewe and several lambs late last week.
So when they tell you that they can't substantiate your claims, and yet, I mean, you've sent me the pictures. You've got pictures or evidence of ewes and lambs that have been mauled. I mean, that's just obvious, isn't it, that you're having these attacks and that's the result of them?
It's obvious to you and me, Angus, and it's obvious to anybody who's farmed in the area that the only animals capable of doing that sort of destruction are wild dogs that are coming in from the Big Desert. But
the department has a different point of view and they're being very, well, you could probably say difficult to deal with, or being very, yeah, basically trying to find any reason not to acknowledge that it's a wild dog doing that that's coming out of the park, coming out of the big desert. And, like, ultimately they make the rules up and that they've shown that now. They've shown with their actions that they have no regard for the position that they put us in or the losses we're continuing to sustain. So their attitude continues to show that.
And you mentioned exclusion fencing. That's basically what the government said, that it's going to be on you to fund and install exclusion fencing. I mean, even if people are in the financial position to do that, that's a long-term project, isn't it?
Oh, it's years. It's years and years, Angus. It's hugely expensive. And you've got the issue that I don't think the power, or maybe they have thought about the implications. So we're not just talking about the implications for us in terms of wild dogs. These wild dogs can roam 10 to 20 kilometres in 24 hours without being controlled in the buffer zone and the fringe areas like we are. They'll just continue to move. And even if we put exclusion fencing out around all our properties, 38 kilometres up in that area, then they can just walk down a roadway or whatever and go past our exclusion fences and go to somewhere else.
And Alan, you mentioned that you expect to get a follow-up visit from the department. What's that going to be about?
Well, I think because of the issues that I've had and the amount of noise that we've made, to be really cynical, I think it's a box-ticking exercise. I think you're going to send some people up to say, yes, they've been on my property, they've looked at the issues, they're considering, you know, what's going on with us, and then nothing will happen.
And, Alan, I mentioned those pictures you sent me of your sheep and lambs that have been killed. I mean, horrific scenes, gaping holes in their sides, basically their guts hanging out. That must be pretty awful to be confronting.
It is, and what compounds the issue is that we're powerless to do anything, Angus. So we find those sheep. I can't ring anybody and say, we've got a wild dog problem. Can we come and control them? I can't put an application to control protected wildlife to get that dog that's causing the problem. We are completely powerless. We just have to turn up and be faced with that situation whenever the dogs want to do it. Drag the sheep away under a tree, bury them, whatever else you want to do with them, put them on a pile of sticks and burn them, and that's it. And then just be prepared for the next time we check a mob of sheep to find the same thing again. It is so soul-destroying. It's just, it's absolutely terrible.
So, I mean, maybe you don't know, but what are you going to do, Alan? Because you know, exclusion fencing is the solution that's being touted, but as you said, that's time-consuming, expensive, and has its own problems. So, I mean, sheep are a big part of your business. What's the future going to hold for you?
Well, at the moment, we're locked into our sheep, obviously, because we've got used lamb and we've got used stand-up for lamb. You know, they're not the sort of things you can jump in and out of, and currently probably at the moment it's not a great time to be exiting the sheep industry either with current livestock prices. I had a contractor out there last week. We've looked at doing some work on our fence lines. We'll continue to work on blocking all the kangaroo holes in our current boundary fence, which we've been doing. But once again, the pressure on those kangaroos entering from the big desert, that's our wonderful neighbour, the state government, who do nothing. To be honest with you, the state government are the worst possible neighbour you could possibly have.
And right now, Alan, as you said, you're lambing. So I imagine those mobs that are lambing, they're going to be particularly vulnerable to attacks.
Absolutely. Yep. And look, the dogs are just, it's the path of least resistance. What's easier to get? You know, an 80 kilo ewe that's going to stick you up, or a 10 kilo lamb?
It sounds like, Alan, you think this whole thing, it doesn't come down to facts. It more so comes down to beliefs or philosophy.
Absolutely. And that was shown right at the start. If the state government was fair dinkum about making a well-informed decision, they actually would have come up and asked some of the farmers and people who've trapped dogs and people who've lived next to that desert their whole lifetime. Nobody was consulted. We're just expected to suck it up and keep on going. Like, it's absolutely disgusting, to be honest. If a dog got in and attacked the politician's pet animals in their backyard, there'd be an absolute outcry about it. But when it's my sheep in my property, then, oh, sorry, you've just got to suck that up, sonny.
That was West Wimmera farmer Alan Bennett there sharing his concerns with Angus Verley. Takes us to 24 minutes past 12. You're on the South Australian Country Hour with Selena Green on this Tuesday. It's time to head to the Weather Bureau. Mark Analak, our forecaster today. Hello, Mark.
Good afternoon, Selena.
What's going on across South Australia?
Well, clear skies is probably the story of the week, really. So clear skies last night. We saw temperatures get down to the low single figures in parts of eastern districts. So I think Narracourt got down to about 0.7 degrees this morning. Glupot down to the low single figures as well. So pretty cool conditions. We're starting to see that across the regions under these clear skies. For the rest of today, we're mostly sunny skies across the state. There are little patches of high cloud around the place here and there, but for the most part, mostly sunny conditions, and we're seeing temperatures starting to reach up into the mid-20s, the low to mid-20s across the state. At the moment, Maree is the hottest place in the state, 25 degrees. Elsewhere, we're seeing Port Pirie up around 24 degrees. So there are temperatures getting up into the 20s. Looking ahead to tomorrow, very similar pressure pattern, I guess. So we'll maintain these light southeasterly winds across the state. Mostly dry conditions are forecast. But one thing we can't see on the pressure patterns is an upper level trough. And that'll be responsible for starting to see some showers or possible thunderstorms developing about the northeast pastoral district tomorrow afternoon. And that'll sort of consolidate more into sort of more extensive showers and possibly even some areas of rain across the northeast pastoral district on Thursday. How widespread that rainfall is could see it stretching out into the eastern parts of the northwest pastoral district through the Flinders and maybe creeping down to northern agricultural areas. But most of the rainfall is expected to remain in that northeast pastoral district before it gradually contracts eastwards on Friday and moves into the eastern states for Friday, Saturday. Friday morning, some of those showers may track a little bit further south over sort of southern, over agricultural areas and the eastern districts of the agricultural areas, but not expecting a huge amount of rainfall as such. In fact, the 4 days up until the end of Saturday, which we mostly, probably Thursday and Friday, we're only looking at less than a few millimetres across sort of the agricultural area, northwest pastoral district and the Flinders district, reaching up to 10 millimetres through the northeast pastoral district, and we could see potential areas of 10 to 30 millimetres depending on where that upper trough goes in that northeast pastoral district, depending on that upper level trough. If we want to see falls of sort of 30 to 50 millimetres, they will be highly dependent on any thunderstorm development as well. So in general, we're looking at 10 to 30 millimetres for the northeast pastoral district and gradually decreasing to less than a few millimetres about the agricultural areas over the next 4 days, which leads into Sunday, Monday, Tuesday. The ridge of high pressure that's currently sitting to the south of us will start to push northwards across South Australia, and we'll see a return to dry conditions across the state for the latter part of the weekend and into the early part of next week. Temperatures remaining above average through the western and southern parts of the state, but under the areas of cloud and rain in the northeast pastoral district, we'll see temperatures hovering below average. So in short, fairly dry conditions continuing for the next week or so, Selina, apart from the northeast pastoral district where we could see some areas of rainfall over the next couple of days.
All right. Thanks for that, Mark. Enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you.
Mark Analak there from the Weather Bureau. So looking at the western inland parts of New South Wales, the forecast for both the upper and western district tomorrow, pretty similar story for both. For the upper western, mostly sunny with east to southeasterly winds, 15 to 25 k's an hour. Overnight, between 10 and 14 degrees, with daytime temps reaching the low to mid-20s. As I said, similar story when you get to the lower western district, also mostly sunny conditions. Light winds becoming east to southeasterlies, 15 to 25 k's an hour in the morning before becoming light in the evening. Between 7 and 10 degrees during the night. During the day, those daytime temperatures are expected to reach the low to mid-20s. It is coming up to 12:30 here on the Country Hour in this next half an hour. There's a lot of inquiries going on into the practices of major supermarkets. There's a national inquiry which is expected to hand down its findings later today, but a South Australian inquiry is just getting underway. We'll hear what the state's veggies producers have concerns around the margins that they're getting and what the supermarkets are charging as well.
You're listening to The Country Hour. For more stories from across the country, go to abc.net.au/rural. On ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill, this is Selena Green. Selena Green.
Afternoon. Well, here's a question. Should the major supermarkets be made to make their biggest profits from non-essential and luxury items rather than staples like fresh food? Well, that's being argued at an inquiry today into grocery prices here in South Australia. Profit margins are a major concern for the state's veggie growers, many of whom we're told are looking to get out of the industry. More on that to come, but keen to hear your thoughts on this one today on my talkback number, which is 1300 222 891, or my text line is 0467 922 891. Also coming up, wine drinkers in India and Vietnam are wanting more and more Australian wine, and that is good news for South Australian winemakers.
One of the importers that I was talking to actually said what we love about Australian wine is that the growers are actually prepared to take on a little bit of risk and shake up the norm. And now the, I guess, that international market is sort of having a look going, well, there's some really cool Montes or Tempranillos or Fianos.
You'll hear from a couple of South Australian producers who are keen to expand into these growing markets and how they're going about that. But first, let's go to headlines with Matt Coleman. Hello, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, residents of Snowtown in the Mid-North are calling for a name change to bring an end to its association with the infamous murders. Police found the decomposing remains of eight people inside barrels in an old bank vault in Snowtown 25 years ago. Since then, the small town has been synonymous with the killings, despite most of them occurring in the outer suburbs of Adelaide. A select committee of the Legislative Council will hear submissions today examining grocery prices in South Australia. The committee is investigating several aspects, including differences between states in pricing, regional price differences, primary producer payment, and the effect of retail pricing on people with a low income. And the Adelaide Football Club will change its name to Goowinna for this year's Sir Doug Nicholls round in the AFL. Goowinna is the Kaurna word for the crows. The club will also unveil a new logo designed by Aboriginal artist Harley Hall, who helped Ford Isaac Rankin design the Guernsey that Adelaide players will wear for the round. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Well, the spotlight is firmly on the major supermarkets at the moment and how their practices are contributing to the cost of living crisis. And while a national inquiry is wrapping up and expected to hand down its findings later today, South Australia has launched its own parliamentary inquiry on grocery pricing. The select committee conducting that inquiry is hearing evidence today. One of those appearing is AusVeg, which represents the state's $2 billion vegetable production sector. And it's got some concerns about the number of growers wanting to exit the industry. It says margins on fresh vegetables are a major issue. Jordan Brooke Barnett is the CEO of AusVeg SA. I've got him on the line. Good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon.
AusVeg SA, you've put a submission into the state inquiry. You are providing some evidence as well today. Jordan, just talk us a bit through your submission, because it does look at what AusVeg SA sees as some of the issues that have led to, well, essentially the crisis that many people are experiencing now in being able to afford fresh fruit and vegetables.
Yes, well, it's a highly complex issue, cost of living, and I guess where we come from it, that's a little bit different to other parties, is, you know, we see what happens at the supplier end. And much has been made of it over the time, but we generally across fresh produce see around a 300% margin between the farm gate and retailer, and that can be up and down depending on the commodities. Whereas our growers are producing for between 1% to 5% net, which is, you know, obviously a big disparity there. So it's an ongoing concern. We're seeing declining profitability in our sector, you know, with 34% of growers, you know, in national surveys wanting to get out. So look, that paints a bit of a picture where, you know, suppliers are really struggling right now. You know, it's impeding our confidence to actually scale up the crops that we grow. We don't have necessary funds to invest for the future. So we're seeing, you know, a real supply side challenge, which is seeing flow through to the supermarkets. But the other part of the equation is the supermarket's commercial behaviour. And look, we don't think there needs to be revolutionary changes, but just moving away from the fixation that we've seen with the supermarkets on margin at all costs. So, you know, a lot of our suppliers are, you know, comparably smaller than the supermarkets. They've got a perishable product that they have to get rid of. You know, so the reality has been that we've seen, you know, very, very thin returns in our game. You know, and perhaps we're the easy mark when you compare us to a Coca-Cola Amatil, a Unilever, some of those big companies. So, you know, it's much easier to strip margin off a grower who needs to get rid of their crop than it is to a large institutionalised supplier. So all we're saying is we need the supermarkets to be a bit conscious about this. It's not where they can achieve the best return. They receive a significant amount of support, and the Australian people have let them get to a stage where you know, there's two big players. You know, we feel that they've got a social responsibility, not to make less overall for their shareholders, but to adapt their pricing in a way which factors in the fact that the consumers need to buy staple produce. So rather than having a 300%, 400%, 500% margin on a bag of potatoes or across fresh produce, that instead that they look to sharpen up what they're doing, you know, in the ambient aisles or for luxury goods, razors, those sorts of things. So, you know, what we see there is a need for the supermarkets to be a bit more conscious of their buying behaviour, to be accountable for issues in fresh produce where we are seeing high markups on produce that consumers need from both a health and nutrition point of view, and to not just take the easiest way out. I mean, farmers will always be the easiest ones for the supermarkets to screw down. We're a fragmented industry. We've got a perishable product. So we just feel that they need to be accountable to that. They need to understand that within their business, that that has consequences both to the consumers, where we're seeing, you know, just because they can, you know, negotiate a high margin and make a lot of money doesn't necessarily mean they should, and they need to be conscious of the fact that that behaviour over the long term is going to affect all Australians, because ultimately it's going to lead to farmers leaving the industry or not investing in scaling up their crops so that consumers can continue to enjoy competitive prices for the food they need.
As you say, there is already that quite that high percentage or concerning percentage of people already looking to exit the industry. Part of that is that frustration of saying, look, I'm working hard here, I'm growing a crop, you know, it takes a lot of blood, sweat and tears to get this, and then I'm getting such a small margin from the supermarkets and then seeing it being sold at such a high markup. That frustration is already leading to a lot of growers thinking it's time to get out?
I think so, more so than ever. I mean, things have been really tight post-COVID, and you add to that the fact that it's 20% more expensive to produce today than it was pre-COVID. Now, that's not all the supermarkets. That's things like energy prices, labour prices, a crippling shortage of workers that we've got in through that we're short from immigration policy. But, you know, you add to that the somewhat adversarial relationship between supplier and supermarkets, and it's a perfect storm right now. Look, we'd hope that with the additional scrutiny that's come on the supermarket through the media and led by organisations like the ABC, yourself, through Four Corners, we'll actually get the supermarkets to look at their commercial behaviour, to examine their KPIs. But, you know, I feel that combined with, you know, the government requiring a bit more of the supermarkets to actually report on the margins that they're charging for staple goods, you know, is a potential way forward on this issue. But, you know, it would require a very minor change in behaviour. And you look at farmers, they're on those razor-thin margins, you know, an extra 2-3% here or there would mean all the difference between an industry that's profitable and an industry that's not making money. So that's sort of where we're at right now. We're eroding our farmer base, which is a scary thing for Australians over the long term, and the supermarkets are taking the easy way out, you know, on a lot of these commodities where they can charge quite a significant markup. So I think there's got to be a middle ground. Like I said, I don't expect them as a profitable company to not deliver profits for their shareholders. They need to make money, and they're an important part of farming in Australia because we do a lot of volume for the supermarkets. But just adapting some of their practices where, you know, if they need to actually recover costs, that's being done through the luxuries and food aisles, you know, for non-staple products, I think that's the way we need to head. And just be conscious of the fact that there are challenges in the fresh produce category. We can't use that as an area where we're making these massive profits. We need to actually ensure that we provide the best price to Australians on these staple products.
I'm speaking at the moment with Jordan Brooke Barnett, who is the CEO of AusVeg SA. AusVeg SA has put a submission into a state parliamentary inquiry into grocery pricing here in South Australia, and he'll be giving evidence at that inquiry today. For the hundreds of growers that AusVeg SA represents, I mean, just how reliant are they on the major supermarkets to make deals with through supply too? I mean, are there many other avenues or options for growers to send their produce to if they don't want to deal with the major supermarkets?
No, the answer is no, not at volume. So if you've got a significant business in Australia, it doesn't matter which state it is, you know, you need the supermarkets and you really probably need one of the big two. So look, in one way, you know, they're an asset. They allow business to plan for the future. It's relatively stable business. They're an important part of the retail landscape. But there is a little bit of work to be done, in terms of how they treat suppliers in fresh produce. So, that's where a lot of our recommendations were, to the current inquiry, that we'd like to see the supermarkets more at the table, you know, being willing to discuss, you know, some of the behaviour of their buyers with industry. It's important that they don't rely on, you know, because individual growers won't complain. That's not because the supermarkets have done anything wrong necessarily, but if you've got 50% of your business with a supplier, you're less like inclined to raise things. So that'll often happen through the industry bodies. But we'd like to see a constructive dialogue around margins, KPIs, you know, how buyers are assessed, how growers can anonymously raise issues, how the supermarkets report on the margins that they're making across staple lines. I think there's a transparency piece there. And how do we actually support, you know, the independent sector in South Australia to get more market share? Because, you know, another way that you can deal with market concentration is to support new entrants.
And in that submission, aside from recommendations around the major supermarkets and their practices, you've also highlighted some of the levers that perhaps state and federal governments can pull in terms of addressing labour shortage issues with migration policy and also around payroll tax as well.
We have, because look, it's not just the supermarkets. We're in a high cost environment for every input. So there's a lot of areas of government policy that touch on that. Our centrepiece of this submission, if you will, you know, and I've seen a lot of other industries raise this, is payroll tax reform, because a lot of our fresh produce businesses, by way of the fact that they've got extremely high wage bills where labour is sort of 30-40% of their costs, they pay a massive bill. So we put that as a quick solution to government rather than grants or any other assistance where we could support producers by freeing up in excess of, you know, 100,000-200,000 within their business that could be quickly reinvested. Because our growers are in a productivity arms race, they're looking to automate, they're looking to bring, robotics into their industry. They're a labour-intensive, high technology business. So look, we put that to government as an option to consider for assistance to our sector. Noting that, you know, in a lot of cases, food producers, you know, we haven't, you know, had a tendency to call out for assistance in the past, but we're in a pretty, you know, challenging, position at the moment. And a lot of the families, you know, they spy me every day. They're going to get through hard work. But, certainly as a potential assistance to growers, you know, we wanted to propose payroll tax reform or an exemption for fresh produce, you know, as a way to free up funds for investment over the short term in our industry.
Jordan Brooke Barnett, thank you very much for joining us on the Country Hour today.
Thank you.
Jordan Brooke Barnett, who is the CEO of AusVeg SA. The Select Committee on Grocery Pricing in South Australia will be hearing evidence today. The National Inquiry is expected to hand down its final report later today, and we'll hear more about that on the program tomorrow.
This is ABC Radio Adelaide, South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, South Australia's wineries export millions of dollars of wine overseas already every year, but there's a couple of emerging markets that are really looking to take off, and that's Vietnam and India. Both of these countries are recent additions to the state government's Wine Ambassadors Club. Seems drinkers there are increasingly keen on what's produced here in South Australia. And this past week, a group of influential wine importers from India and Vietnam travelled to the Barossa. They met with around 30 local wineries and forged what's hoped to be some lasting relationships and signed some deals. I caught up with a couple of the winemakers involved. One of them was Nick Radford from Miras Vineyards and Wonderground, and asked him what these markets are looking for.
The delegates to the South Australian Wine Ambassadors Program tasting were generally from warmer climates, so India, Vietnam, Hong Kong, for instance. And I think consumers in those markets are looking for, you can't generalise, but I suppose sometimes we have to. But so there's definitely fine wine drinkers in those markets who are looking for wines with more of a story, but there's also wines that are appropriate for that climate and the cuisine as well. So I think we had wines that appealed to both of those markets and those consumers, and I think that a lot of the delegates there were surprised that they had preconceived ideas maybe of what Barossa wine was, and hopefully we sort of changed those perceptions a little and provided some wines that really got them thinking about the potential and opportunities for their local markets.
When you're trying to tell that story and in a competitive market, to have ambassadors from those countries literally walking through the door and being able to not just tell them that story but have them taste that story as well and then go back and share that story in their home country, it'd be hard to put a value on that.
Absolutely. For small producers especially, to sort of reproduce the opportunities that came through the program, it would take us years to do that. We've already got a vetted group of wine importers from very important markets to us that were engaged, and they are committed to taking on new wineries. So very, very much appreciate that opportunity. We're a relatively young winery. I've been in the wine industry for 30, 40 years now. But as a new winery, a new project, we've made a huge commitment in terms of investing in vineyard and land and cellar door and gallery facilities, in the western ridge of the Barossa Valley. But the challenge for us is we've got to be great growers, viticulturalists, winemakers, small business people. And at the end of the day, we have to be quite forward thinking about sales and marketing. And so to have all of those skills, it's enough of a challenge in itself. But to have these kind of opportunities put forward by the South Australian government are very, very much appreciated and welcome. And particularly with the challenges around the tariffs in China, the challenges around that, and it wasn't just people who were exporting directly to that market, it was the greater industry has been almost catastrophically affected by those events. And again, very, very welcome to have assistance in broadening our market base. And the other thing that we're really appreciative of is the work that's gone into trade agreements with India and Vietnam in particular, the work that's gone into those relationships before this event has very much helped Australia be top of mind when it comes to wine in those markets.
That's Nick Radford there from Miras Vineyards and Wonderground. Well, Lockie Allen is a family owner of Barrister's Block, and he said it was a hugely valuable opportunity for a small business.
It's super important for us as a small producer to be able to grow and look at drawing in new contacts. And part of the, South Australian Wine Ambassador Club has actually helped us start those introductions. And to be honest, it was actually a really efficient way for us to zoom down the road, set up a little display, meet and greet a lot of these people, and hopefully form some really good contacts going forward.
So as far as exporting goes, are you doing any of that at the moment? Are you looking at any of these particular markets to start or grow your wine into?
Yeah, so we're looking at, currently we export to a couple of little markets, or sort of high-value markets for ourselves. We're not a huge brand, but we just look for small sort of high-value opportunities, and at the moment we're looking, we'll have some wines in Japan, working on some pretty close to one actually into Korea and other Southeast Asian markets. But we're sort of looking to broaden our horizon a little bit with places like Vietnam. India is obviously growing. There's still more opportunity in Japan and Korea and places like that. So to help build our contacts to try and, I guess, move, you know, we're looking for that next sort of 5-10 year sort of growth opportunity, and we're trying to sort of put ourselves in the right position to take advantage of that.
Yeah, and unless you've got events like this where you've got delegates from those countries walking in through the door and tasting your wine, how hard is it to develop those relationships?
Yeah, and that's one of the tough things with wine. You know, unless we're prepared to literally pack a suitcase and get on a plane and head to these countries to engage, you know, direct with either the consumer or importers over there, it can be a pretty expensive, you know, cost to the business to do that. So to have these little events for us is actually really beneficial, because it just means we can build up that, like I said, that contact list. It means we can start engaging now, and we probably will support that with an in-market visit, you know, over that next 12 months. And then we know when we're going to maybe one of these countries that, hey, we've got a contact we can reach out to, or we can start some conversations around our brand and where it might place in market, which could lead to hopefully us finding that market opportunity as well.
We're hearing a lot about these particularly Asian markets that are growing and growing in their interest in Australian wine. Were you able to learn a little bit through this process about what kind of wines and what drinkers there are looking for, and whether what, you know, you're making there in the hills sort of fits with that?
Yeah, and I think, you know, one of the good feedbacks yesterday was one of the importers that I was talking to actually said, what we love about Australian wine is that the growers are actually prepared to take on a little bit of risk and, you know, shake up the norm. And I guess traditionally we have been a large exporter of Cabernet and Shiraz, but we've got so many new emerging varieties. And, you know, as a winemaking business, we're looking to sort of craft different avenues, and not only for Aussie drinkers, but now the, I guess, that international market is sort of having a look going, well, there's some really cool Montes or Tempranillos or Fianos, just these new varietals that are looking. So that was something I picked up yesterday, that normally they do look for those traditional, you know, Cabs and Shiraz, but there definitely was interest in those new emerging varieties. And something the Adelaide Hills, we're very fortunate that we've actually got a wide spectrum of varietals, so they'll really happy to get into the hills and see what we could do as a little region.
Yeah, and I guess that must be exciting as a producer to think, well, there maybe there's an opportunity to have a bit of play here as well. I imagine that must be sort of a bit of fun to think, well, I can perhaps take some risks and have a bit of a play with some different things, and it might pay off.
Yeah, and we're lucky as our business, we're a relatively large sort of direct-to-consumer business at the moment, and it gives us the ability to sort of experiment with some either new varietals or new winemaking styles, and we can actually sort of test it really quickly on our customers within our cellar door, so we can get some feedback, you know, almost weeks after we release the wine to know, is this a good one? Should we continue and should we invest further? And we've found that with a couple of varietals of what we've done, which has actually led us to keep that on the list moving forward.
That's Lockie Allen there from Barrister's Block. One of India's leading wine and spirits experts, Nikhil Agarwal, writes for the BBC, GQ and Good Food. He was part of the delegation, and he explained a little bit about India's changing wine consumption.
30 years ago, there was no wine consumption in India unless you were extremely, extremely rich. When I say extremely, means like the pinnacle of being rich. Or, you know, way back if you were like a Maharaja or something like that, all right? And since then, India now has about a few wineries of its own. We make wine in India. You have over 2,000 plus brands available from all over the world in India. You have stores that sell only wine, which was unimaginable. You have the largest store in Asia for wine and spirits, and they have multiple stores of that size. You have all hotels have wine programs. All restaurants take wine seriously, have sommeliers. Being a sommelier is actually a career option. There are articles on wine. If you watch Netflix and you watch content made in India, people are drinking wine rather than drinking whiskeys. That's what the previous generation content was all about. And so wine is coming in a way that is you and I can't fathom how fast wine is growing in India. And in any civilization, once they get more developed, you tend to move away, your lifestyle choices start to change, right? So you can see that in everything. Indians are buying more art, Indians are traveling more, they're buying better cars. They're you know, spending more money on food and drink. They're drinking better spirits too. They're drinking better tequila, but they're also drinking wine. And I think in today's day and age, I think it's impossible for any restaurateur to open up a new restaurant without having a credible wine list. And that is a reflection of what is going on in India right now. And so even when it comes to food, local food, it's changed from being, you know, what you think of a traditional Indian meal. When you go to restaurants, it's more course by course now. It's a little different. And now a lot of that food, local food, done differently, is only paired with wine at the restaurant itself. So it's a huge moment for India.
That is one of India's leading wine experts, Nikhil Agarwal, there. And the South Australian Wine Ambassadors Club is part of the state government's Wine Export Diversification Program. It was launched back in 2021. It's just going on 5 minutes to one. Well, finally today, do you remember the name Jack Byrne? He was a 10-year-old trailblazer who started the Fiverr for a Farmer initiative, raising money for drought-affected communities. Now, 6 years later, 16-year-old Jack has a registered charity called Jack's Mates Foundation, where he continues to support rural communities.
I was watching a BTN clip, which is news for kids, and there's a little segment on the drought, and I saw kids my own age really suffering from this drought, and I thought I needed to make a change. So went home, wrote an email, and came up with an idea, and it all really went from there.
And what was it about these kids, I guess, that you saw and how they were sort of struggling through in drought-affected areas?
I just kind of thought about, like, how lucky I was. Like, these kids on Saturdays, they weren't playing sport. Some of them weren't even going to school, and I don't know, I guess that really lit a fire in my belly, and I just wanted to make a difference for them.
And had you been out to sort of, you know, more, I guess, rural parts of Australia before or seen what farm life is like?
I've been to many farms now, but before this all started, I'd barely left Sydney, so, yeah.
How was it to, I guess, go out to these places and see, you know, the people for yourself?
Definitely a big eye-opener, and to see the dedication and hard work these people went through, it was actually really inspirational. I've been so lucky to have so many cool opportunities and meet so many amazing farmers and people.
What are some of those, you know, bigger opportunities that you've had since you started?
Yeah, I've been really lucky to do a lot of cool things. I've done a TED Talk. I've met Mr. Morrison when he was Prime Minister. I got to go on all sorts of TV and radio, and I've talked to so many cool people, and, you know, I've learned a lot from that, and I'm really grateful for that.
Could have you ever sort of expected it to get this big from when you started?
Oh, no, not at all. When I first started fundraising, I think I thought I could raise maybe $1,000. That was my main goal. It was pretty cool to smash that out of the park.
Some of those conversations that you've had with farmers and those that have been impacted by drought, I guess, what has that looked like? And have you kept in contact with these people?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I have such a great outreach, and I'm really fortunate for that. I get lots of emails from farmers on what's happening and what they need, and I've talked to so many amazing farmers and heard some really cool stories.
You're speaking at an event coming up. Could you give a little insight as to what that's going to be about?
Yeah, so I'm speaking at a Stand Tall event in Sydney, which is in the ICC on June 6th, and, you know, I just can't wait. I'm so excited.
What are you going to be chatting about, and who's the audience?
So the audience is school kids like me. I'm going to be chatting about my journey, and, you know, I'm aiming to promote change-making, and I feel like our generation is going to be the generation of change, so I really want people to get behind themselves and, you know, try and make a difference in the world.
That is Fiverr for a Farmer founder, Jack Byrne, there, and he was speaking to Lily McCure. If you'd like to watch Jack's talk, you can register to live stream the event. Head to the Stand Tall website, standtall.com.au. 2 minutes to one. Nicolai Balhart's again with you for Afternoons. Hello.
Hello. We're going to follow something that you were discussing a little bit on the program yesterday, this news that Telstra is delaying shutting down its part of the 3G network until August, because there were a couple of interesting texts that were coming through about just kind of bringing up questions about, well, at what point, how does your phone decide which network to go to, and does it ever give preference to, for argument's sake, 3G over 4G? So when 3G is turned off, you will still have coverage, or is 3G kind of the last resort now? So we'll take a look at that. Also in tech news as well, Google has launched this new service today in Australia where you can put your details in, so your name and phone number and email address, and it'll do a big search of the internet and then report back which websites have published your details.
Oh.
And then you can... apparently go to those websites and say, please take them down.
Please take
them.
Yeah.
Yes. So we'll find out how that works. We normally talk movies of a Wednesday, but we're going to do it a little bit earlier today as well, because there's some new data out that the amount of sex scenes in movies has dropped by 40% in the past 20 years. So we're going to find out what's driven that change.
Oh, yeah. Was that... No. You know, I'm not going to go there. I'm going to go Google my address.
Okay. Please do.
Thanks for your company today. It's news time.
To get started with the ABC Listen app, find the App Store on your phone. Search for ABC Listen, tap the pink ABC Listen icon and download it. Congratulations, now you've got ABC Radio in your pocket.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.